The recording is now started. Is there anyone who wants to go first?
Hi, this is Celine. I'm happy to start. Can you hear me?
Barely.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on. I was on a speakerphone. Okay, can you hear me now?
Much better. Much better.
Okay, so I will quickly update everyone. So the project I'm doing is this. It's great for what Vinny's going to talk about, but kind of a medical education intervention in terms of trying to get students involved in high-value care. And we had this great pitch day back in December, which went really, really well. It was awesome to see the students really engage like this. So now we have the fun thing of actually getting these projects up and off the ground, starting with the second semester of the year. So we get that meeting pitched off tomorrow. So what's been really rewarding is, as I said, actually seeing the students move forward in this direction. I think what's going to be challenging is to get students, many of which don't really have a clinical expertise yet, to really develop projects that are going to be effective working with the leadership that way. Measuring these things, I think, is going to be challenging, but I'm up for it. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for going first, Lee. Does anybody have thoughts on how to, I guess, ensure that a medical student's project has the wisdom that is required of it, if I'm hearing it correctly?
Do the medical students at your institution have to do, like, a research day poster or something along those lines, like a quality improvement poster?
They are very much encouraged to, and the goal is certainly that they would eventually be able to present this at that, yeah.
And are they assigned a mentor for that, like, research project?
In this case, because it is very much in the QI way of things, that would probably be me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, there goes my thoughts.
Yeah, the
but I mean, there are plenty of people that we are working with to try to guarantee success here in terms of making sure that there's wisdom to guide. Yeah.
Hey,
this is Mary.
No, you go. Oh, go ahead. Okay, this is Winfred.
Winfred.
Number one, Celine, what year are these students? And
that's the thing. A lot
two,
of them are first years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Because, all right, they'll need a lot of mentoring then.
Yes, there will.
Okay.
But a lot of enthusiasm.
Okay. So. Right, so, right. And they have 3 years to complete this project, so that's good too.
I'm hoping
so
we're like.
What,
go for it, Mary.
One thing from the start, this is Mary, one thing from the startup kind of world that, so my partner's in the startup world and they're working with high schoolers on trying to develop these startup ideas. And one thing they're doing is actually this idea hack where they're going to have thought leaders in a room and the students have to do their pitch. And then they basically develop the idea in that room based on the student's pitch, but with like tremendous amount of feedback from these kind of thought leaders.
Mm-hmm.
To refine the idea and define the question. So you could think about something like that, like some sort of like we're going to spend an hour with three mentors, you know, to kind of
mm-hmm.
bounce ideas off of each other based on your pitch.
That's a great suggestion. Thanks.
So anybody else want to chime in on their project? And again, update and Beth and Trick. Go ahead.
So I'll chime in. This is Morgana, and mine is probably not exactly like high value care centered. Apologies in advance to many. It's more looking at the impact of financial toxicity on a select population of cancer patients. So at Moffitt, one of the faculty that I work with works with a lot of patients with head and neck cancer. And just from a socioeconomic standpoint, those patients are prone to that particular disease because of the smoking and alcohol consumption that's associated with it. And oftentimes they'll present with very advanced disease and are faced with a lot of economic challenges when it comes to accessing care. So one of the things that's come up a lot in oncology is this concept of financial toxicity and whether we should be thinking about patients' ability to afford their medications and how that impacts their outcomes when it comes to disease management. So it's been looked at in a couple of other spaces, but not in the head and neck population. So that's, I'm kind of gathering some anecdotal data on that now to see if there's something that we can design from an intervention standpoint later.
Any challenges so far?
From a chart review standpoint, I think it's been kind of challenging because, you know, obviously this is data that I'm kind of calling from what has been recorded in the chart, and it's not exactly like a metric that we're looking at right now. So mostly I'm just trying to find out if that question is ever asked or if the patient ever has ventured concerns about costs, and if so, what was the action that was taken. So for us, I think because we don't have an easily searchable EHR, it's been kind of piecemeal, and our EHR in particular is not very friendly. So like a lot of other docs, I think I'm just frustrated with the electronic medical record. but that, other than that, my faculty, my attending is really behind it. He thinks it's a great idea.
You know, even identifying if the question is asked would be useful.
Yes,
agreed.
Of course. Yes, of course. Yeah, just from a qualitative standpoint, I agree.
Yeah, well, and that could be quantitative, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like just the frequency with which did your doctor ask you about financial hardship. I don't know if Vinny wants to chime in.
I'd be happy to. So, Morgana, I think some of my comments might be of interest, but in terms of the specificity for your project, I don't know if you're familiar with an oncologist here at University of Chicago named Jonas D'Souza, who's developed a metric of financial toxicity and has launched a new website, costsofcancercare.org. And,
oh, wow.
And is actually, if you just, I think that's the name of the website. If it's not, just email me offline and I'll get it for you. But basically, okay. They have developed this very, very sensitive metric to financial toxicity and are using it to collect data on a variety of different patients and have a very frontward patient-facing component to their project. Anthony, thanks for putting it in the chat box. So, I think that that would be at least one connection that I can facilitate for you that of somebody who's been thinking about this and could be a wonderful collaborator for you.
Thank you, Vinny.
All right. Well, so I think the early birds are the ones who got the feedback this time around. Noting that it's 9:15, I think we should probably move on with the agenda. Of note, the folks who were on the Google Hangout actually already had a chance to bounce some ideas off the group as well. Unless anybody has anything super urgent, I'm going to go ahead and move forward. Anybody last thoughts on projects? Okay. Well, in that case, we'll move to the next part of our agenda. So you've already heard Vinny speak, and you can tell immediately that she's quite connected within the internal medicine field and the world of adult education. So I have her bio, and it was emailed to you. I'm just going to go over it as well. But I just wanted to say I first met Dr. Vinny Aurora at the QIIQ Summit in January 2014 in New York City. And she had to follow Chris Moriades, who's an excellent presenter, and she managed to wow the audience of academic hospitalists and residents, really for an entire hour. And I still remember aspects of the talk for GotMed mnemonic and some of the video teaching techniques that she used. And then I've had the pleasure of working with her on a couple of projects, and she's really a natural leader and a natural educator. So I will now tell you that specifically, she is a board-certified internist an academic hospitalist and assistant dean of scholarship and discovery, director of the GME Clinical Learning Environment and Innovation Chicago. Along with that, she has gotten money from AHRQ and the National Institutes of Health and the FDA for some of her projects in developing innovations. Of note, she has authored more than 100 peer-reviewed publications, many with trainees. She's done much mentoring throughout her career and has been honored for this. She has been noted in the New York Times and on National Public Radio and the Associated Press. She also works at costsofcare.org. She is the Director of Educational Initiatives, and so she co-chaired the Teaching Value and Choosing Wisely Challenge. She's also one of the authors of the first real book on high-value care, Understanding Value-Based Healthcare. She serves on the board of directors at the American Board of Internal Medicine, spending a lot of time in Philadelphia of late. She has been recognized by the Society of Hospital Medicine's Excellence in Hospital Medicine, the research award to that extent, the American College of Physicians, which gave her the Walter McDonald Young Physician Award, and the Society of General Internal Medicine, which gave her the Brancati Mentorship and Leadership Award. So if there's any doubt that Vinny's an excellent educator, a natural leader, people follow her when she leads, and the evidence for that is that if you look on Twitter, she has 22,772 followers. Who followed her at Easter Doc. So without further ado, I would like to turn this call over to her for her presentation, which we all look forward to. Thanks, Vinny.
Great. Thanks, Anthony, for that wonderful introduction, and I'm really honored to be here. And actually, it's great to connect with former students of mine, like Celine, as well as people I've known through the channels of organized medicine, like Morgana and others. I will start off by saying that I am going to be sharing some ideas that I have gathered early in this, sort of teaching value movement. And this talk is a relatively new talk. I just gave it at Grand Rounds, actually at UCSF, Morgana. So hopefully you weren't in the audience, but if you were, it's okay. I'll bring out some new points.
I was not in my defense.
Okay, great. Well, then you didn't miss much. So we'll go ahead and get started. And I realize that I have to. Okay, great. So here are my disclosures. And as Anthony mentioned, I do receive royalties from a textbook. I have a grant from EBIM Foundation. And actually, I do have an NIH grant that is actually not relevant to this talk, but was relevant to an earlier talk. So the objectives for today are really to describe a conceptual framework for how to align medical education and the health system to improve the value of care provided by residency trainees. And I'm going to share sort of these pearls that I'll encapsulate as use the force, and it'll be clear why I'm saying use the force. But one reason that I did say use the force is that at least at UCSF, I also disclosed that I was a huge Star Wars fan. And the reason that I used Star Wars was at UCSF, they have very specific instructions for their grand rounds, which is to start with a funny, poignant anecdote that really connects with the audience or a story. So I actually did an opening Star Wars theme crawl, which I won't be able to share with you, but I'm happy to share with you offline if I ever see you. With the music, the whole nine yards and everything, which actually garnered applause, which I was grateful of. But then I said it took me 5 hours to develop that one slide, so really I need to get into the rest of the talk. So without further ado, what is this conceptual model? Well, you may have seen this in JAMA. This was work with Reshma Gupta, who's a UCLA RWJ fellow, who's working with us at Cost of Care on the Teaching Value Healthcare Network. And for just a plug, we actually have a session tomorrow, which is always the third Thursday at noon. It's a Google Hangout, and you can register bit.ly/teachingvaluenetwork. But together, the two of us thought, well, how come medical education is not doing this? And a lot of it, medical education is housed in academic health centers. Well, why are academic health centers not doing this? And the key is that they're not really aligned. There's really a big silo problem. So we wrote about the need for bridging leaders, people that are going to bridge between the health system and medical education, engage the front line, and go for the win-win. And And what I will tell you is I actually have come from a background in medical education as associate program director, but a few years ago I switched my role to be one of these bridging leaders. And so now I have a dual reporting to GME as well as the C-suite about how to engage residents in quality, safety, and value initiatives. And we're starting to see some real traction there. And so I'm going to share, well, what are we seeing there? Why is this important? Well, some of you guys have heard about the Clinical Learning Environment Review, which is this new ACGME, kind of a site visit process, which is really looking at whether optimal learning environments for safe, high-quality care are achieved. And here's pathway number one. How are we doing in training and overuse and diagnosis of treatment of patients? So it's there. So how are we doing? Actually, I was lucky to work with Mitesh Patel, who's now a faculty at Penn, but was at the time a fellow, to look at AFCM data, Association of Program Directors of Internal Medicine data. And it turns out that, you know, at the time in 2012, programs, only 15% had a curriculum, but 50% were thinking about having a curriculum. So it was kind of on people's minds. But when we looked at the most common methods of teaching, it was informal, 76% of the time. And then assessment, as you know, is an important thing in medical education. You know, not many people were assessing, and 36% of the time it was a faculty member. And we actually did further work to say, well, are the faculty role modeling cost-conscious care? And, in fact, 50% felt no. So you really have to get the idea, well, who's teaching this? And if it's really this informal learning, you know, and if the faculty aren't on board, how are they going to get on board? And so why is that? Well, as a lot of you know, there's this powerful HISI curriculum where there's an imbalanced focus on identifying rare diseases, and I think all of our teaching conferences emphasize this. People are punished for sins of omission, you know, that we've talked about celebrating restraint. You know, people say, why didn't you order that chest x-ray? It's never like, thank you for not ordering that chest x-ray. And then misperception that considering cost is not aligned with patients. And so being a Star Wars fan, this is what Yoda would describe for the hidden curriculum. You must unlearn what you have learned. And so, well, what's the force and why is that important? Well, as many of you know, the force is really everything around us. And so the hidden curriculum, it's not going to get solved with the formal curriculum. Teaching, like in this setting, or, you know, if this was so easy, then we could just solve this with a one-hour lecture or a web module. But we can't, as Celine is highlighting, it takes more. And so, so really, you know, the force is about using everything at your disposal is the way that I would highlight it, including everything in the built environment, and to Morgana's point, using the electronic health record, using every system piece that you can to kind of align the education with the system. So here are the five ways that I've described, well, what is the force? Cultivating situational awareness, which I'll highlight in a minute, finding the right champions, observe and understand cultural norms, and nudges to promote the right thing, and then redesign the system. So what is situational awareness? It's really a mindfulness of the patient environment. This comes from the patient safety world where, as you guys know, if you do a surgical timeout, there's a reduced likelihood of medical errors. And simulation is one way to do this. And one thing we've wondered at our institution is, well, can we really cultivate a situational awareness in our interns about low-value care practices? The nice thing about situational awareness is it's behavioral. It's not knowledge. It's like, I'm going to change your behavior through this exercise. We were lucky to be able to do this through a GME orientation boot camp that we have for all 125 incoming interns in all specialties. And, partnered with hospital leaders. This is part of my bridging role. We developed a case, which is a C. diff pneumonia case. Obviously, it's a, high-impact hospital-acquired illness. There's a 12 hazards of hospitalization. 8 of them are safety-based. 4 of them are low-value-based. And the intern has to go in and figure out, well, what's what. And for the 8 patient safety ones, obviously we picked things that were, like, relevant to either our organization, like hand hygiene, or things that were, like, part of our ARC patient safety indicators, like things we were reporting on Medicare, VTE prophylaxis, et cetera. Well, what about the low-value hazards? These came from choosing wisely. I literally looked at all the lists and said, okay, what applies to general patients, and interestingly, and it was that I could operationalize into simulation. And so I really tried to operationalize telemetry, but I couldn't because, it's a mannequin. So we had unnecessary restraints, unnecessary Foley, unnecessary blood transfusion, the patient on a hemoglobin of 9, and there was really no indication for that, as well as unnecessary ulcer prophylaxis. And so how did our interns do? Well, they did great on the safety stuff, hand hygiene, 96%. But let's look down at, 0%. Nobody out of 125 got unnecessary chest ulcer prophylaxis. Only a few got unnecessary blood transfusion. So this is really important coming into the organization because, we now have stood up a blood transfusion committee and have reduced unnecessary blood transfusions by a third. And I'll tell you in a minute what we've done about unnecessary chest ulcer prophylaxis. But this is really highlighting that, we really need to kind of get people to think differently because a lot of the interns said, well, I saw that it was there on the chart, but I wouldn't have questioned it because it's there. Why would I change it? So that highlights the difficulty in recognizing when something is there that needs to be stopped. It's very different than, I need to start something. That's a very, very different skill. What's sobering data for medical educators is that prior training in trachear value had no relationship with your performance in this room. And so really you got to ask, we don't know what kind of prior training they had, but it was interesting because there were so many people unsatisfied with their prior training. We had to stratify, and there was a significant group that were unsure that they had prior training. So you can imagine that right now we see that in medical school, Lisa Spleen's kind of getting at this, really there's, it's a kind of a hodgepodge. And so I would say, anything you can do that's a little bit more rigorous and skills-based is going to be more sticky than just the knowledge-based piece. And obviously the interns really liked this, and, you want as an educator to have them really like what they're doing because that's why they'll do it again. We also did a survey 1 month into internship, and 69% were more aware of identifying hazards, and half had already taken action only 4 weeks after internship to reduce a hazard included in the room. So while we don't have outcomes data yet, we still feel that this is a very important behavioral approach that made them change. So now let's talk about finding the right champions. And for this, we took a page out of the Cost of Care Playbook, which is a nonprofit that Anthony mentioned, which does a lot of crowdsourcing. So we've crowdsourced ideas, and I invite all of you to submit for our next rendition, which will come out this fall. But we, University of Chicago, did its own internal crowdsourcing challenge. We said we're seeking the best ideas for residents and fellows, called the Choosing Wisely Challenge. Submit 500 words, any idea of how to actually improve value, and hopefully tie it to choosing wisely. And interestingly, the project that won, not surprising given that last data I showed you, was stress ulcer prophylaxis, because that was really sobering data. And it was a very specific, and this is the SHM Choosing Wisely about stress ulcer prophylaxis. It was a very specific one. So it was called Skip the Drip. And it was the idea, several residents had gotten together with some fellows and said, we have too many drips that are being used, particularly proton pump inhibitor drips for GI bleeds. Everyone gets put on a 72-hour drip, and then they stay on it. And, in fact, they're not even going to get scoped, or nothing ends up happening. Or they get scoped, and it was low risk, they never had an ulcer. So in order to really address this when in thinking about using the force, we said explicitly you couldn't just do training. You had to do something around culture, oversight, and systems change. So this is the COST framework, which was put forward by our group, including Carissa Neal at Cost of Care, but developed by Andy Levy, who was a resident at the time with us, actually when Celine was a medical student working with us at Cost of Care. And so the culture piece is really what they had done was they were going to recruit subspecialty faculty champions to email their peers. So the faculty found out about this initiative from their peer faculty, not from the residents. The oversight, the pharmacy was going to receive a monthly audit of PPI drips ordered and why. Epic now requires indications for PPI drips when ordering. And interestingly, the residents learned that by partnering with pharmacy, pharmacy had carte blanche on-demand service to change Epic whenever they wanted. That's very different than changing the EHR in any other circumstance in our institution, which has to go through this massive prioritization and queue process. But with, if you work with a pharmacist and they're on your team, you know, obviously if a new drug comes out, they have to be able to change the way medications are ordered. And so they actually have that capability in real time. And so this team was able to be awarded this challenge. They won it in May. Their intervention in Epic went live in June or in July, early July. And so they were just in time for the new interns. So, so this is our fellowship program director who they recruited after they won the challenge to be like, please send out our email. So what's interesting about this, and this is just sort of a brochure that highlights kind of what they were asking people to do, which is forgo using PPI drips and discontinue PPI drips when the endoscopy does not show anything other than a high-risk lesion. And one thing that's interesting is the resident champion for this project was rotating in the ICU when another attending who was not aware that this resident was actually the impetus for skip the drip said to the intern, oh, you know, I see these patients at proton pump inhibitor. Shouldn't we skip the drip? So some of the other residents started laughing because they realized that, you know, oh, they, this he mentioned it, but he has no idea that his resident is the leader of this initiative, and he knows about it because the faculty have been championing it. So it really highlights the team-based approach to improving care, but also changing the culture is also about partnering with the right people at the top as well as at the bottom. So I want to go forward. So what are our early results? This is basically 3 months of data. The team is still doing chart audits right now. But they were able to show that after a scope, the percentage of discontinued PPI drips has gone from 64% to over 93%. So it's been a big jump. And in addition, a balancing measure is that the people, you know, you worry, okay, maybe we're not giving PPIs to the people who need them. And it turned out that the team was also measuring guideline-based usage of PPIs, and that had gone up. So there were some people who needed to be on the PPI but weren't getting it. And so the balancing measure shows not only did they reduce waste here, but they actually improved the percent that were supposed to be getting it. And that's really the value win because you're improving care while also reducing cost. This group also did time-driven activity-based costing to try to motivate the residents and the physicians in this intervention to try to improve. So this is still an ongoing project, but I share it as a way to really highlight the important role of champions as well as crowdsourcing to find the right people to do this type of work. So I want to share one other project that also came through the challenge, which is also addresses a choosing wisely a measure, which is about don't test for myoglobin or CKMB for acute myocardial infarction, instead use troponin IRT. So this is Matt Mose, who's the PGY3 and also leads our pro chapter, which he's part of Anthony's group and really, really, a true resident leader in high value care. This is his initiative, Ordering Wisely. I'm not going to talk about the other three, the ANA, folate, and thyroid studies, because this is actually a bundle of four things you shouldn't do, and this is the handout he created. We're really doing well in the other three. I'm just going to show you, well, why are we not doing well in cardiac biomarkers or what it took to get there. And so this, again, is important to using champions. So as you can see, his handout really is very, very detailed, and it highlights that the evidence, you know, the Crusade trial, the GRACE registry, highlights the guidelines. And it even goes so far as to give shame and competition. Hey, Mayo, Mass General, Brigham and Hopkins have already done this. We can too. And then it dispels myths, which is that troponin rises earlier than CK and troponin is more specific for acute MI in end-stage renal disease. And so, you know, we haven't had the progress that we need to here. And this is actually total cardiac biomarkers resulted at U of C. And you can see, interestingly, what we didn't realize is, wow, most cardiac markers are actually ordered in this ER cardiac panel bundle. And that's the thing that's basically popped up in Epic. And so there's really, you know, you have to really get people to get rid of the ER cardiac panel or because they don't like ordering troponin. It's too hard to order troponin by itself. It's just easier to order the panel. And interestingly, the panel is so easy to order that it gets ordered on a lot of outpatients as well. And so also, you know, this took a lot of faculty buy-in as well. There were, we had a cardiology champion, two champions, in fact, but there were, all it took was one cardiologist who was kind of not on board to say to the cardiology night float, why did you not order this? This is terrible. For then all of a sudden, all of that work in this area kind of started to kind of really take a hit. And the residents were like, well, I'm going into cardiology and I want to look good. And of course, Matt was like, oh, good thing I'm not going into cardiology. He already matched in pulmonary critical care. But you can imagine that this really led us to think, well, are we really outliers here? What's going on here? And I will say the happy ending of the story is that with the support of the quality chief and a lot of meetings later and kind of really helped a lot of people coming to Mass Aid, we've actually been able to modify the ER cardiac panel and are going live with that this year. So more to come there. But thinking about are we outliers, we're actually fortunate to have a relationship with University Health System Consortium here in Chicago, which benchmarks academic hospitals. And this really gets at the importance of culture, because I was thinking to myself, okay, is this, are we the only hospital that's still doing CKMB, or can I show data to show that we're really outliers? That would motivate people to change. Then I got this data, which is from 6.4 million encounters in 83 academic teaching hospitals, and sounds like, you're not an outlier. Everybody is all over the place. So this really gets at the importance of culture. You don't really know, you have to figure out, well, where are you in this space? But data was more interesting than that. It actually, we had them split it up by time, and this is by quarters, from 2011 fourth quarter to 2015 second quarter, and you can see the incidence of troponin only for rule out myocardial infarctions is going up, and so NCK and for troponin and CKMB is going down, and so you do see that there are hospitals that are like leading in this effort. And one question was, well, maybe this is a result of choosing wisely, and we need to point at that, but choosing wisely actually took place pretty late in this game, 2015 quarter one. So this really gets at that cultural piece where you've got to know where you work. And are you in that leading environment where everyone in the cardiology department is going to be on board with you? Or are you going to need to kind of really massage this and plan on taking a year like we did to figure this out? And so this is, gets at my fourth piece, which is observe and understand cultural norms. And I don't mean to imply that University of Chicago is Darth Vader by any means, but to highlight that there is, there is a very, very, kind of hardwired way where things are done around here. And if you're butting up against that, you're going to have a hard time. So you need to kind of respect those cultural norms and figure out how you're going to slowly change them. Now, I'm going to skip over embedding nudges to promote the right thing, but in the speaker time, if anyone is interested in that piece, and Morgana might be interested, I can talk a little bit about a project that we're doing to improve patient sleep and disruptions at night that's looking at nudges. But I'm going to end with how to redesign the system, which seems daunting. Like, why, how can residents redesign the system? And this is where I would say redesign a system that they have control over. And so the one piece that they have control over is this resident clinic handoff. And so some of you guys know that when one resident graduates, they kind of hand over their cases to the other resident in the outpatient arena. It apparently affects 1 million patients a year. And so several of our residents knew this was a problem and highlighted, well, hey, this is a real problem. Let's look at this. And so the first thing we did was study the process. And so for all of you kind of that are starting out and, I think Morgana highlighted, figuring out, well, who's screening, et cetera. This is really very helpful, which is just kind of get the patient experience of, what is happening when they go to clinic. And so we found that many of our patients were being transitioned to their third PCP in 5 years. And actually, it wasn't a scheduling problem. 97% of them were scheduled, which was great. It turned out that, the problem was that 29% were a no-show or canceled their first new PCP visit. And when they did come, only 44% saw the one that actually received the handoff of them. The other just kind of saw whoever and was a new patient to them. And not surprisingly, by 3 months, one quarter of all patients had an ED visit or hospital stay. I mean, that's a huge number compared to the rest of our clinic and compared to the rest of the resident patients when we're not looking at clinic handoff time. So And so by 6 months, one out of every five was lost to follow-up, which is also pretty dismal. And one of the main problems was resident ownership. Only half of the residents said, this patient is mine, because they were actually half of the residents said, the patient is not mine until I see them in clinic. And you can understand where, well, if they're not getting to clinic because they're no-showing, and then, of course, they're going to fall off the radar. So this is, of course, a problem with, and many of them are coming back into the ED and hospital. Again, addressing high-value care, and when you think about high-value care, one critique a lot of times people get is, oh, well, you know, fixing labs or fixing, you know, PPIs, that's not going to really make a huge dent. But when you tell people, you know, oh, we've got a one out of four coming into the ED, that actually is a huge amount of money. So what we did was we actually went to patients and said, what are your solutions? And we did some interviews. And actually, I could go through the whole thing. We redesigned the process, including giving residents telephone visits so that they actually had to call their new patients that were on this high-risk list. But I wanted to discuss two that would never have come to the fore were it not for patients giving us advice about what to do. And the first was to recognize patients for their role as valued educators for trainees. Specifically, we said, why don't you come to your first clinic visit with a new doctor? You know, how come that's not a size? They're like, well, I don't know that doctor. Right? To them, that makes perfect sense. They're like, my old doctor left. I don't know this new doctor. Why should I come? Not knowing that the handoff even took place. So they thought, well, if they weren't recognized for their role as educators, they would want to come meet the new doctor, as well as the importance of personal sharing. If they knew something about the new doctor, they'd be more likely to come. And so this is just a snapshot of the letter that goes home to the patients to say, I'm a second-year resident. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm from, you know, Iowa, other than working as a doctor, you know, I enjoy, ice skating here in Chicago. My name is pronounced, you know, Barack. My picture is on this letter. And then here was the certificate that also went home with patients to recognize them for their role in the training mission to say, you know, you're a valuable part of our resident education. So we were really excited about that, and we thought, hey, and we ended up making, like, you know, not really making any budge. We did not budge at all, and we were like, well, why didn't we budge? And it turned out that, you know, we asked our patient champions, did you guys get this packet? What happened? And they were like, no, I don't know. You know, we get a lot of mail. And then, you know, they said, well, what if we, like, put something colorful on it or something that really highlighted that you needed to open this piece of mail that was a little bit artistic and kind of, you know, appealed to the human side of it as opposed to, you know, literally thinking it was some kind of bill and or an insurance adjustment. And so we partnered with a nurse that we met through social media, a comic nurse who's actually sort of a comic artist in residence at Northwestern. And she did a comic for us called Mrs. B Changes Doctors. Actually, this comic has been published in JDIM and Annals of Internal Medicine now. And it has, like, you know, nine slots. And one of them is, the church is having a lunch on the 10th. I'd love to go, but I can't miss my doctor's appointment. So highlighting, you know, you've got to get to that first appointment. And so then after that third year, that was 2012, we started to make a dent. So you can see that the 26% and 19% were the figures that I showed you from the first process. But by 2012, ED visits had fallen from 26% to 16% after 3 months after the handoff, and loss to follow-up had gone from 19% to 12%. So we started to see some massive changes in the numbers that we felt, okay, not only are these statistically significant, but we know that this is, you know, this is really the triple aim. You know, we're providing better care, higher quality care, at lower cost. And so what I wanted to end with is, you know, obviously ways to use the force to teach value. So find the right champions, observe and understand cultural norms, redesign the system, cultivate situational awareness, as well as embed nudges to promote the right thing. And so when I was on my way to UCSF to give grand rounds, I'm like, oh, my God, this spells out the force. So that's what I mean by using the force, which is don't just rely on the fact that a lecturer is going to do it. In order to teach value, and to, it's really about the experience of improving value and engaging your residents in this piece. I also wanted to end with, if any of you happen to be Star Wars fans, here are some of my favorite quotes that also relate to teaching value. We already talked about, you must unlearn what you've learned, but use the force. Do or do not, there's no try, as well as stay on target. So with that, I have many people to thank for a variety of different projects here, and I would be happy to take questions at this time. And Anthony, I can turn it over to you to facilitate that.
Yeah. So on behalf of everybody, so thank you very much, Vinny, for that presentation. And it is. I did not see that coming. That it spelled out the force, but I was delighted to see as such. So I had a few thoughts and questions, but I wanted to first open it up to the group. Specifically, is there anything that resonated very powerfully with anybody that they think, A, was a good idea, and B, might possibly be something they could deploy on their own campuses? I'll turn that over to the group.
I mean, this is Sumer Akhtar in Las Vegas. It's funny, I actually just did a grand rounds on this sort of topic on the University of Nevada yesterday, and had I heard your talk, I think my talk would have been twice as good at least. So, one of the things I'm working on is trying to design for, I don't know if you know much about the Las Vegas medical community, but it just seems that there's not a whole lot of organization and very little talk about innovation beyond. Sometimes it feels like the only thing that matters is what is sort of the next thing we can use procedure-wise to charge patients more money or insurance more money. But
I see.
So after I came here, I decided, one of the ways to reach out to the community was to try to create sort of an innovation curriculum for the residents at the University of Nevada. And so my hope is to sort of create a monthly or bimonthly innovation curriculum for them and sort of help them work through, things that are going on in their resident-run clinic and other places. And so I guess the question is, as you design this curriculum for their educational half-day, what are the pitfalls to worry about when you first start something like this? I worry most about how do I get buy-in from not only these residents, but also how do I get buy-in from the faculty that are going to be sponsoring their projects and helping them out?
Right. And I would say that's where, this goes back to that bridging leadership issue where, is there a, faculty respond to the C-suite, that's kind of who helps with all of that piece. And so, what I would definitely highlight is who is your partner in crime that's opposite med ed, that's in the C-suite and operations, who's going to be able to go with you and say, hey, this is a great idea. We're supporting this educational initiative because we think the faculty need to get behind it. And that would be one way. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a C-suite person. It could be, in our case, for example, that GI fellowship director who's really almost acting chief, somebody of that stature who's a well-respected clinician goes a long way. For the CKMB issue, when we had kind of come into the hurdles with the cardiologists that were not on board, wanted to do things the old way. What happened was the person that came to our rescue was the Department of Medicine quality chair, and he was like, I'm going to take this on. Matt, you've done an amazing job. You've gotten us this far. You're a resident. You have to go back to being a resident. This is going to be my personal mission this year. And so some of it is, there are people, there are like-minded people in the organization, people in the culture. If it's so hard to do the right thing, it's that in curriculum, right? The dark side. If it's so hard, good people do bad things and they are not able to see the light. And so what you often have to do is really show them you can do the right thing. I can empower you to do the right thing. And you've got to, in a lot of this change management speak, you have to find your friends, find that guiding coalition that's going to blaze the trail for you. But you also need to create that sense of urgency. So for you, if the faculty are not even sensing that, healthcare reform is coming, we cannot keep doing things the same way, then they're not going to hear that message from you. I guarantee they will probably hear it from that leader. Now, if you don't have a leader, if your C-suite's not about that right now, that's where it gets very difficult. And then I would say, that's where you're not going to have as much traction because the informal curriculum is not going to be changed. And so it's not really the best answer that I, you know, best answer that I can give, but I'm also open to others kind of providing their experiences. But so many stories that I've heard of culture change is all about leadership. And it's not necessarily every leader, but there's one leader that's able to align with you and make it happen, you know?
Thanks, Jenny. And that makes sense. I had actually submitted the same sort of idea, so what to do about the anti-champion, as I sort of quoted on the chat board. And it's like one entrenched head of a department can really dig in, but I think there's this sort of idea of almost passive resistance. You know, butting heads is probably rarely helpful. Building a growing number of people who you know are sort of on your side or your team is powerful in and of itself.
Right. And well, the other thing is I should say don't discount the low-hanging fruit. So if Matt's project was only CKMB, that would have really, really sucked for him, right? Because he would have been like, mm-hmm. Oh, I have nothing to spend. But we went through four things, right? And folates, there was really no controversy over folates. There was no anti-champion being like, oh, yeah. I want the folate in the anemia, right? We had the papers. You know, we knew it was there. Similarly, and fascinating, like, when you talk to people, rheumatology was like, no, I don't want to be pan-labbed, pan-labbing for this to occur because I just end up getting consulted and it's a nightmare, you know? And I wouldn't have ordered it anyway. And, you know, but now that it's there and it's positive, I have to work it up. So, again, a lot of it's just having that dialogue. Now, I realize a lot of the residents in our organization are like, oh, if I get a room consult, I have to order all of these things. And really what that reflects is that the rheumatologist is like, you're clinically asking me, is there a rheumatologic disease? So you think that the clinical suspicion is high enough because they don't know the patient as well as the primary team, but you think the clinical suspicion is so high that you're calling me so I will tell you what labs to order. That's literally what they said to us. When in fact, what's happening is a lot of times, as you know, you're kind of like, well, maybe it's rheumatology. Let's have a room consult come because maybe they'll do a better history and figure that out and see if we really need those rune labs. When, in fact, they're thinking, oh, you're so worried about rheumatology. And even though they may not agree, they're like, oh, the doctors were really worried about it. They're the primary team. Let me, order this and just cross it off and make them feel better that it's not rheumatologic disease. So, again, that consult becomes so easy to order with an electronic health record without the conversation that that's where we were seeing a very different lens that was being applied. So the residents were like, oh, they just order labs, whereas Room was like, well, of course you're calling me to help you because you're so worried your patient has rheumatologic disease, you don't know what labs to order, you know? So that was actually a good sense of buy-in. So, again, start where you can, and sometimes you have to go after the low-hanging fruit and table some of these larger projects. And so that's, again, where that's the observe and respect cultural norms. If your chairman is this pro-CKMB, you're not going to get that project to fly, right? And you may need to wait, or you may need to kind of, start with some other areas, but that doesn't mean that you're not out of the game completely, you know?
Other questions for Vinny? Comments?
Hi, Dr. Rohr. Thank you. This is Chris Petrilli from University of Michigan. So we started to do a similar thing where basically we've been trying to target low-hanging fruit in terms of things that pretty much have no indication ever, at least on the inpatient side, is where we've been focusing most of our attention. And so it's basically just me and two other people that have been kind of spearheading, trying to, kind of manage 8 or 9 projects that other people are trying to work on. So I've been focusing on inappropriate thrombophilia workups as an inpatient when people come in with some kind of PE or DVT. Other people are working on inappropriate use of anti-rejection or antibiotic levels. And then we have overuse of troponin. We did the CKMB where we just kind of took it away. So you can't order CKMB anymore, even if you want to.
Right. Right, you're on our champion list. You're one of the institutions we were using to motivate Shane here.
Right, so that's what we've been doing. And when I talked to one of the higher up people, I won't mention his or her name. But when I told him about our idea, thinking he was going to say it was a great idea and then give us a bunch of resources to try to get more people to help, he or she basically called them squirrel projects and said in the scheme of all this amount of money that we're spending, that the thrombophilia workup in the scheme of things as opposed to reducing length of stay or some other bigger projects doesn't really matter. So how would you, not necessarily to use the word combat, but how would you
right.
come back to them and say it's better than nothing, but saying that a little bit better?
Well, so again, you have to actually think about your where you have to lead from where you can, right? So, not knowing exactly what your position is, my husband's health economist.
It's low. There's only like one person lower than
So my husband's a health economist here, and his position is fairly high, and he's sort of in care redesign. And so this is what he says. I mean, he says this to me all the time, which is, this is not going to save, this is peanuts, And in order to save money, we have to, why did Willie Sutton rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Go for the high-cost utilizers and solve that problem, and then we're on board. And then I'm like, okay, that's great. Everyone's fighting readmission, and if we can solve readmission, then we'll save a ton of money. The key here is that when you think about at least active learning, opportunities for residents and initiatives in your institution that are tackling those high cost issues, they're not going to be things that residents can actually do, together and use as a project or use as an initiative that they're leading. And so they could technically inform an initiative. They could serve on a committee that they probably couldn't make all the meetings to. But they're not going to have skin in that game. That's going to be a longer institutionally led project with a lot of other people. And so that's why I presented, I didn't have force. I had just the four pieces. I added redesign the system, and that's when I'm like, oh, I have force now with the R. And I added that because I was a little bit of jerry rigging around the others. I added that because I felt like I needed to address the critique that you raised, which is, how are you going to, what about, the CKMB? Is it really actually going to save tons of money? And the answer is, no. However, if you look at the data, it's not chunk change. Institutions are paid on the order of $100,000 on this. And for example, the PPI, they did the cost thing. And, the question is, how much does it cost? You have to do the time-driven activity-based costing exercise to really tell people how much things cost. Because if you look at, what are you going to really look at? The Medicare reimbursement rate or the charge master? That's not really the same thing as saying, examined the time cost of, hanging extra antibiotics, or in your case, the workup of a thrombophilia. So, an RVP, our lab tells us by time-driven activity-based costing that running an RVP is thousands of dollars. Now, we don't charge thousands of dollars for an RVP, nor are we reimbursed thousands of dollars for doing a respiratory virus panel, but the time cost and the labor cost, and you add all that supplies and everything, it's very costly. And so that's where you have to let people know from the supply side, you are saving money. It's just that you're not seeing it because we were never reimbursed for it anyway. So that's where we're getting more efficient. The second thing that I would say is, in terms of your thrombophilia workup, you can almost use the example, and this is actually the example that we use with inappropriate labs at night with our some of our sleep projects, because a lot of people are like, this is patient experience, this isn't value. And I'm like, if you get 4 a.m. labs on a patient and that hemoglobin shows a drop and you end up doing a massive workup, which I know this happens as an attending, and the patient stays, you have not hit discharge before noon, you've left a patient that's standing in the, waiting in the ER for a bed, and you possibly, that patient missed their ride or something where they could have gone home. And so all of these have a spillover effect into length of stay when you're talking about hospitalization, because they're all kind of adding to it. And so that would be my comeback. And I would also say, at the end of the day, what's high quality care. And that's why choosing wisely in some of these metrics, they're not necessarily like, there's no dollar signs attached to each choosing wisely metric. What it is like, these are things you should not do. I mean, same thing with the NPA, you know, top five. You shouldn't do these things. It's poor quality care. And when it comes down to it, when you defend it to a patient, no patient would be like, oh, you did an unnecessary thrombophilia workup. I mean, that doesn't really sound correct, you know? So if you think about it as a patient and go in with that attitude, well, patients demand this, and this is the way to high quality care. And this is our first project, and we're going after this one because this is one we think the residents can have a lot of confidence about. If this works, we're going to go after our bigger project, which is redesigning the system or tackling unnecessary radiology imaging testing, you know, something bigger that then people would be like, okay, I can get behind that. You had some traction. People were ready, you know?
Perfect. I like that. Thank you very much.
So I'm conscious of the time here. As we've reached the 10 o'clock hour, I first off want to thank Dr. Nidora for joining us this evening and for sharing these slides and her views and informed wisdom on the topic. I need to turn the call over to Becky Martin for a minute or two just to go over logistics for next month. And then I have one very important question for the group, and then we'll just mess. Becky?
Yeah, just real quick tonight, I want to remind everybody to mark their calendars for Wednesday, February 17th, same time, 9 o'clock East Coast time, for our next call. And those of you who are in the path of the snow, please stay safe and warm over the weekend.
I totally agree. And just on a completely unrelated note, I finally saw the new Star Wars movie this past weekend, and it was shockingly good. I am curious if the group agrees.
Yes.
I definitely agree.
Totally agree. Great movie.
It was pretty awesome.
Yep, I agree too.
Me too.
Likewise, I agree.
Did anybody see it?
Homework?
I did not see it.
I did not see it.
Who's that?
This is Mary, and I have never seen Star Wars, like any of them.
Mary, did you understand when he talked, or...
just all so right. Over my head.
I think that was that's a warm audience for Star Wars. All right. Well, unless anybody has anything else utterly drastic, we will adjourn until next month. Please join me quickly in thanking Vinny and everybody. Have a nice night. Okay. Thanks, Vinny.
Thanks, Vinny.
Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. Good night.
Good night, everybody.